Hi, everyone. I'm Tammy Halevy from AEO. I'm really excited to welcome you all to U.S. Microfinance at the Crossroads, a virtual roundtable on scale and sustainability. We've organized this conversation to promote an industry-wide dialogue, and I emphasize dialogue. AEO's defined its focus on changing the way that capital and services flow to underserved entrepreneurs so that we can grow and hire. As we first said 2 years ago, and we keep saying again and again, hopefully louder and louder, if one in three microbusinesses hired one employee, the country would be at full employment. The themes we plan to cover today are certainly not new, and none of the leaders in U.S. microfinance and microbusiness support on the phone today are strangers to balancing the competing challenges of mission and money in pursuit of impact. Business owners, along with your partners and your funders, count on you all to do the heavy lifting in a rapidly evolving environment. What we do think is new and we think is really important is the opportunity for regular, thoughtful, and open dialogue, including the right mix of individuals. So today is our first public effort to facilitate that conversation. It certainly won't be the last one, and we hope that you and countless others will join the conversation too. We would be remiss if we didn't express our thanks to many of the supporters of the change that we seek to unlock. The City Foundation has been present since the creation of the One in Three initiative, and we are grateful to their support. Mary Reynolds Babcock supports AEO's capacity-building work, primarily focused in the Southeast. And through that work, we also want to thank a relatively new funder, the Newell Rubbermaid Foundation. A couple of things about the conduct of the session. Again, we really want this to be a discussion. We would prefer to have done it in person, but we can't wait until the conference, AEO's conference, or other in-person venues to engage. We also don't think that industry-wide change can happen through just sort of conversations once a year. So here's how we expect the session to work. Ira, Jennifer, Joyce, and Connie will kick us off and share some perspectives. Then we'll move into threads of discussion. We want it to flow freely, and so we'll give as much time for conversation as possible. You need to know that this conversation is being recorded, and the way you'll need to manage your phone is push *6 to mute your line and *7 to unmute. So that's *7 to unmute when you are ready to speak. And you can indicate your interest in speaking by raising your hand and or using the chat function in the lower left-hand corner. If at any time you have difficulties with the system, send an email to Jackie Orwick at Aspen Institute. So, you'll see there are a terrific group of people representing a range of stakeholders. We have not-for-profit lenders, both small and large, more established and emerging. We have Opportunity Fund. We have People Fund. We have Entrepreneur Works. We have VEDC and lots of others. We have credit unions, very large and very small. You'll see we have a couple of folks from self-help. We have Beverly Coffee from North Dade in Miami and Laura McKinley from a small credit union in Georgia. We also have not-for-profit service providers reflecting a range of target markets and geographies. We have Patricia Harris from the Edge Connection, who I must acknowledge is AEO's board chair, Phyllis Cassidy from Good Work Network, the folks from Rising Tide and Women's Initiative too. We also have some impact investors, at least scheduled to join us, Bill Burkhart from Impact Economy, Joy Anderson from Criterion Ventures, and Shannon Bond from Shannon Bond Advising. And, of course, we have as well advocates, John Arnsmeyer and Small Business Majority, Gina Wood from the Bipartisan Policy Center, and, of course, Claudia Vieck from Cameo, also a member of AEO's board. And we have some interested regulators, like Keith Ernst from the FDIC. In addition to the wisdom of the group that we can tap into for this conversation, we have some additional experts to really acknowledge and thank. First, the two authors of the paper, that is the catalyst for this conversation. Ira Lieberman and Jennifer Mudd. So Ira has had a long and illustrious career in both the private and global public sector. Among his many achievements, he's the founding executive director of CGAP at the World Bank, one of the most important entities for unlocking investment and change in global microfinance. We couldn't have someone with more expertise who was present at the creation to share perspectives. With Ira is Jennifer Mudd, who also brings a wealth of expertise to the table. She's worked for many years on microfinance and small enterprise development in the transition economies of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union when she was with the EBRD. Now she works as a consultant for the Calvert Foundation and to CARS, and was a co-author with Ira and Phil Godive on this paper. Finally, the group is rounded out by some industry leaders, three long-term watchers, practitioners, and change agents. Mary Houghton is with us. Mary's a woman who needs no introduction to microfinance practitioners in this group. Among her many contributions here in the U.S. and abroad, I personally am most in awe of the vision to have started ShoreBank many moons ago to really push the envelope of what conventional wisdom dictates to show us what can happen. I'm glad you're joining us, Mary, and your participation will, you know, help us continue to push this space in the U.S. We have Joyce Klein, who you all know as the director of the Field Program. Joyce is new to the formal leadership at Field, so again, congratulations, and congratulations publicly. We all know the work Joyce and her colleagues at Field have done to bring data and experience base to this conversation. And finally, we have Connie Evans, the president and CEO of AEO. You never really want to introduce your boss. You all know Connie as the president and CEO of AEO. Some of you knew her as the founder of WESEP in Chicago many moons ago. I know her as a visionary woman who convinced me to join her on a journey to change the way that capital and services flow to underserved entrepreneurs. I hope you'll agree with me that we have a fantastic group here. And now let me hand it over to Ira and Jennifer to take us through their perspectives on U.S. Microfinance at a Crossroads, the paper they wrote for the Calmetto Foundation. Ira, Joyce?
Thank you so much. I know we're under some pressure time-wise because we want to leave lots of time for your questions and for discussion, but I'd be remiss if I didn't thank both Connie and Tammy and AEO for continuous support in making introductions to us, to the industry, for reviewing the paper, and for supporting this webinar to the industry. And I will be at the annual meetings and hope to see many of you there in person. Also, Field, Joyce, who has commented on this paper throughout, she's also met with us and also made introductions. And finally, our Jackie, for all the technical arrangements, we wouldn't have gotten on, any of us wouldn't have gotten on without her. And also, I'd like to thank our sponsors, Calmetto and Omega Foundations. By chance, they're both Canadian foundations. Calmetto has been involved with microfinance for many, many years, and it's too complicated to explain how two Canadian foundations sponsored this, except to say there is also a Canadian report, which was very different in scope and so was separated at the end from this report. So on to the key questions that were explored in the report. First, we looked at scale, a great difference between the international sector and the domestic sector is how much scale there is amongst institutions internationally. And we were concerned is why has scale been more limited domestically? And so we explored the issue of scale. Then we, as our report moved on, we became quite concerned about the issue of financial sustainability, or you use another term for this, which the microfinance industry internationally used to use, but basically, do you cover your costs? Can you cover your financing needs? And also, if you want to attract capital from the private market, can you generate some return on equity and assets, and we're talking almost solely about the microfinance lending part of the business. I know many of you provide lots of other services. Finally, is there the potential for non or not-for-profit microfinance providers to commercialize them? By what we mean by that is having shareholders and their ability to attract in private investors. Now, we're not suggesting the whole sector move that way. We're not suggesting anyone move that way. But that's a phenomenon which happened internationally. I'll go into it briefly in a minute. Now, for the other three items, we'll get to those as we move along. So I will now pass to Jennifer.
Okay, thanks, Ira. So first, before jumping into the next slide, I just wanted to take a minute to talk about the approach that we took in our work. So Ira and I really spent a lot of time analyzing the U.S. microfinance sector by reviewing a number various sources of data on the industry, both the international and U.S. side, including numerous research papers and articles and obviously a lot of field publications. We also interviewed by telephone and face-to-face a number of individuals that represented a diversity of institutions in the sector, so some that you see listed here as nonprofit microfinance providers, low-income credit unions, emerging for-profits, et cetera. And finally, I think as Ira already alluded to, we asked a number of readers to review the draft document, including Tammy and Joyce. And the readers represented an array of expertise in the sector, both on the international side and the U.S. side. So if we can move on to our next slide. So here what we wanted to look at, well, in our research, we realized there are really four different segments and or types of providers that are providing microfinance. And you all know these well, but I'll quickly hit the highlights here. So the not-for-profit sector, mostly the microfinance, micro-enterprise development organizations and CDFI loan funds that are providing loans, training, and technical assistance directly to micro-entrepreneurs, some of which are offering, as Ira said, much more than just micro loans, but is offering as well small business loans, doing affordable housing, community facilities, et cetera. Then credit unions, low-income credit unions, or community development credit unions, some of which are certified by the U.S. Treasury as CDFIs. That was interesting to explore. It was a little bit difficult on our end. They're not, credit unions are not required to report on loans below $50,000. So it was hard for us to really get a handle on the extent of microlending that they're doing. Thirdly, we looked at the new emerging for-profit sector, so institutions that are lending mainly to Main Street businesses like On Deck Capital, some that are lending primarily to consumers who are using some of those funding, some of the proceeds of the loans they receive for business lending. And that would, we went out and talked to Progressive Financiero, that's an example there. Also to some low to moderate income entrepreneur institutions that are lending to the low and moderate income micro-entrepreneur market. When we were doing our research, Confianza was still separate from Opportunity Fund, but that they are now, as you know, together, and we were also looking at our microlending in Florida. And then did a little bit of looking at organizations that are lending to their own small business customers or small business members, as in Sam's Club. And then we also wanted to take a quick look at alternative lenders to see what was going on in terms of payday lenders, check cashers, pawn shops, et cetera, to see how that impacted the sector. So those are the four main areas we were looking at. And I think, Ira, you've got the next slide.
No, you have the next one.
Actually, Tammy moved it.
All right.
So we're going to get to it later.
All righty. Thank you. I see it up there. I was looking at my deck. The main difference in terms of this paper versus others that you may have looked at is we try to draw lessons from the international experience. And as Tammy indicated, Jennifer and I, and to some extent Phil Goodeve, who primarily focused on Canada and the for-profit institutions, all had the background to look at the international sector and try to draw comparisons. So when I started CGAP in 1995, if anyone knew anything about international microfinance, they knew the name Grameen, and if they were really insiders, they knew Bank Rakyat Indonesia and Banco Sol in Bolivia. What's happened since then, and most of the other institutions, and there were many of them, were NGOs, and they were relatively small, and they were relatively non-sustainable. What's happened since then is there's been a dramatic scale-up in the industry worldwide, including to the transition countries and including to some of the poorest countries, including I chaired a special facility for Haiti, including to Haiti and West Africa, East Africa, and countries like Kyrgyzstan. So it's now a global sector. What's also happened is the industry has moved from being primarily NGOs to having a diversity of forms, including cooperatives, but the biggest trend has been the movement to commercialize vehicles that have transformed from NGOs, that many of which are supervised by the banking supervisors of their countries. The microfinance banks can mobilize the savings deposits, which is a very important product for poor people, as well as a source of financing for the financial institutions. And we've seen substantial high growth and ability to tap money from the private sector. And in fact, much of it is public-private, as there's been the formation of about 70 different debt funds covering the globe and 30 different equity funds, providing more than $7.5 billion to date to the sector. Now, I think the other, the emphasis has been to diminish the subsidy level, and here is where I think the debate or the differences are very critical, to reduce the subsidy level, to recognize you cannot depend fully on the donors for the long term, to be able to attract money from capital markets or the interbank market, or from banks in their domestic market on quasi-commercial terms, and also to attract money from these debt funds or equity funds, which I've mentioned. And finally, so that meant the institutions had to charge sufficient interest rates to cover their costs, to cover their financing, and providing an adequate return. And finally, I think a big difference with the domestic industry is that most microfinance institutions internationally started with a plain vanilla product of working capital loans that were less than 1 year in term, and they were paid back on a weekly or biweekly basis and amortized very quickly, and the payment of loans allowed people to receive subsequent loans, so there was a very clear technology involved in the microfinance sector. Now, only now in recent years have we seen the addition of education loans, savings products, transfers, remittances, microinsurance on the base of a very large client base that is already sustainable and profitable. So that is where the essential differences are. So let's see if we can get the next slide up. The other issues I think that were critical is the fact that there was a lot of money available for technical assistance support. CGAP, which I managed for 5 years, and then Elizabeth Littlefield, who now runs OPIC for the U.S. government managed to subsequently consistently made technical assistance funds available, usually on a 3-year basis, which became quasi-equity. The grants became equity to these institutions, but to build capacity. And I think that's been a much more difficult thing for the domestic industry to obtain. That is capacity building money on a consistent long-term basis. I think I've mentioned the other issues, so I will we'll move on from here and pass on to Jennifer.
Okay. So we're getting ready to jump straight from the beginning of our paper to the conclusions, and there's a lot in between that we don't have time to talk about in our presentation. But I did just want to mention that we spent a lot of time trying to understand the differences between the operating environments internationally and on the U.S. side. So the conclusions that we reach, they do take all of those differences into consideration. And as you know, there are many differences in the operating environment which have affected scale and sustainability here in the U.S. versus on the international side. So on the conclusion side, we tried to break it down into different institutions, types of institutions. So on the nonprofit side, we're really looking at mission-driven institutions that are providing a host of different important services to the community, to micro-entrepreneurs. They're currently, for a number of reasons, not scalable. We believe that one of the reasons is that they remain fragile due to dependency on subsidized funding, much of which is subject to budget appropriations and CRA regulations. So when we're thinking about the institutions in that light, one of the things we were hoping to recommend out to the industry for consideration is, you know, given the industry accepted need to continue offering technical assistance and training at little to no cost, which is an important part of what these institutions do, can nonprofit, in particular CDFI loan funds, reorient themselves to focus on achieving fully sustainable lending operations? So really trying to break out the lending side from the TA grant side. And in that, doing so would likely require an increase in interest rates. In our paper, we were thinking to levels of between 18% and 36%, which is pretty high compared to what the industry is charging now. And that would take a pretty significant paradigm shift on the part of government agencies and donors, creditors, regulators that set interest rate caps, and in some cases, even the management of the CDFI loan funds themselves. In terms of credit unions, what was interesting about them is they are really well-structured, we thought, to support microlending operations, and that they're already operating on a financially sustainable basis. They're community-based. They raise the majority of their funding from member deposits. They're regulated as well. And they have the potential to scale if they are able to access secondary capital or grow through mergers or acquisitions. And I'm speaking particularly here of low-income credit unions and community development credit unions. The question in our minds really was, you know, to what extent are they currently reaching micro-entrepreneurs, and do they have an opportunity to make headway on the front of reaching more? And if so, are industry leaders, in particular regulators, willing to and able to champion the case for increased levels of microfinance via these types of credit unions? So that's still, I think, for us, a big question mark. We don't feel that we really quite understand that side of the industry yet. And with that, Ira, I'll let you hit those last 2 points.
Yes. We became very interested in the emerging for-profit players only because some of them seem to be filling the gaps now not filled by the not-for-profits, but more important, a few of them were drawing the lessons from international experience and even had people who had worked internationally, mainly in Latin America or in South America. And we felt that they would be a very good test of principle of the ability to scale and commercialize for the sector. And again, we're not pushing the suggestion that everyone move to a for-profit status, but we believe that there could emerge some champions from amongst the not-for-profit sector, which could scale either as not-for-profits or commercial institutions. So you're all aware of the few key experiments going on with AEO and OnDeck Capital. We thought OnDeck Capital's approach was interesting. We thought in the Latino community, particularly Progreso's work on the West Coast and now moving down to Texas, was a good example. And I think one that's going to emerge and going to be very large scale just because of their resources is Sam's Club. And Walmart has tried for years to own a bank and was sort of blocked by large banks lobbying. They do have a very successful bank in Mexico that is doing something akin to microfinance, but really doing banking through their customer base. And so we think one should observe very carefully what the emerging for-profits are doing. I think technology is going to be a real issue, and it's coming very quickly. The best example is remote banking that's going on through cell phones in Kenya. Vodafone's affiliate there, Safaricom, has 15 million clients already doing microfinance and not using banks whatsoever. There are similar experiments in the Philippines and other countries in Africa, and I think branchless and remote banking is coming very quickly in the United States. It's just going to be an extension of smartphone usage for other apps, and I think the industry should be watching this very carefully. One of the big issues is going to be the ability of the industry to charge interest rates sufficient to scale, and I think that's very much a debatable or an item for debate within the sector where I know we don't have agreement. And finally, on the CDFI bond guarantee, that had looked to us while we were doing our report as a potential long-term financing instrument for the industry that would make up for the episodic financing, the very important but episodic financing that comes from the Treasury or from the Small Business Administration or from the commercial banks who are operating mainly through their foundations or through CRIs. I understand it's still debatable how useful it will be to you. And most of you have probably kept up better with it than we've been able to keep up with it. And finally, my last comment is that we think a very important achievement that CGAP was able to implement was a comprehensive database that's self-reporting on the industry, but is rated by Diamonds, which indicates the quality of the data. I know the field has done a lot of work in this area. AEO has done work in this area. Treasury has data. SBA has data. I think there's the need for a more comprehensive database, and a lot of your sponsors, like Citi, have actually been sponsors to CGAP's database, which is an affiliate of CGAP called the mixed market, and if none of you have looked at it, you might want to take a look at it. It represents a database of 2,000 institutions all over the world with quite a bit of detailed data, including audited financial statements. So I'll end here. So we allow time for comments from Joyce and Connie, and then for those of you who have been patient on the line to raise questions and have a discussion. Thank you very much for your kind attention and participation.
Thanks, Ira. Thanks, Jennifer. Now we're going to invite, as we said, Joyce Klein to share perspectives on the paper from Thiel. Over to you, Joyce.
Great. Thanks, Tammy. I guess just before I jump in, I'd just like to thank first Ira and Jennifer for their thoughtfulness and how they've approached this paper and for all the back and forth they put up with in the course of it between us. And also to Tammy and Connie and the team at AEO for convening this event and for inviting me to be a part of it. And what I'm going to do here is just sort of share a few thoughts and reactions as we begin the discussion of the paper and its implications. So this is just a quick slide here. It's some of our, not even quite our most recent data from MicroTracker about sort of the scale of microlending in the U.S. I mean, basically what it points out is that there's a relatively small number of folks who've really achieved any level of substantial scale, by which we would mean several hundreds to thousands of loans. And I'm not going to dwell more on, I'm going to really focus more on some reactions and comments to the paper. So the first thing I want to say is that there are a couple of points that Ira and Jennifer make that I absolutely agree with and think are critical to this conversation about scale in particular and also to sustainability. The first one is that one of the challenges I think we've seen in the U.S. in terms of achieving greater scale in the field has been that we have not had the core investments to build the institutional capacity to scale that the international field has seen. And I think from our perspective at Field, many of you know we've been engaged for several years now in a project called the Scale Academy for Microenterprise Development, where we and AEO as a partner have been working with a number of leading organizations in the U.S. that we're really interested in and focused on scaling up. And I think one of the key lessons we've seen, there's been a lot of interesting work, a lot of great experimentation, some real growth among some of those organizations. But I think one of the key things that we learned is that money in the kinds of critical investments in the kinds of organizational capacity you need to grow, whether that's technology or staffing or investments in market research and customer acquisition, all those kinds of things are really hard to come by. That a lot of funders want to give, well, they are happy to give you money for capital, they are happy to give you money for direct program delivery, but that capacity building piece has really been a significant challenge in the U.S. The second area of agreement I think will come as no surprise to folks, and that's a point that Ira was just making, and that's about the importance of data. So obviously research and data is a key piece of what we're about at Field, and we absolutely agree that the data is key to driving higher performance and growth. It provides the information that organizations need to be able to diagnose challenges, to figure out where there may be inefficiencies in their system or opportunities to grow, and it also provides the information they need and the data they need to attract investment. And so actually Ira and Jennifer make a nice endorsement of MicroTracker and the work we've been doing to try to build that kind of database, which is really modeled on the idea of the mix. That's in a much more nascent phase than the mix, but there are lots of things we could do to improve the power of that tool. But we really think that the data is critical to this. The third thing that I think we would agree on is the need to think really hard about the business models for the field, given the changing technologies, the new players that we're seeing, excuse me, and obviously the constrained funding situation that we're increasingly facing. At Field, we've been working with OFN on a capacity building initiative for CDFIs that's specifically focused on scaling microfinance. And it was very deliberate that the first piece of the curriculum that we developed is one that looks at business models. The other three components that we think are critical are technology, product development, and human capital. So those are all, those three areas are what I'd say are sort of our three key areas of agreement. Then there are several places, I think I should say, where we disagree. So there are several points or implications in the paper that I take issue with or that I would take a different take on, and I'd like to talk a little bit about those. The first one is really the definition of sustainability, which Ira and Jennifer equate ultimately to profitability. And at Field, we've always distinguished between self-sufficiency, which we define as the ability or extent to which an organization covers its costs with earned revenues, and sustainability. And I think the paper suggests, and Jennifer just used this language, that the business models that involve subsidy are inherently fragile or unsustainable. And I want to make 3 points about this. So the first one is I think actually an organization can have a successful business model that involves subsidy, as long as the model clearly demonstrates and delivers value to those actors that provide the subsidy. And that's in part what the nonprofit sector is all about. And so that's just a key part of their business model is it involves subsidy, but you have to demonstrate value to those who are providing the subsidy. I do think that in today's environment, given, you know, the federal funding picture, given the economic context, given the disruptive effects of technology, that all businesses need to think hard about their business models. That's clearly true for nonprofits. They need to be thinking about how to increase earned revenues and self-sufficiency. They need to be thinking about many other parts of their business model. But I'm not sure that it's true that institutions that are for-profits are necessarily less challenged to think about their business models. I think if you think about the nonprofits who are on our, the for-profits who are active in our sector, you know, given what's going on with technology, given what's going on with regulation and how that's shaking up the marketplace, I think they also need to be thinking about their business model. And I'm not sure that business models that remain static can be sustained. So I think, you know, in the for-profit sector, if you look at some of the work that Langdon Morris has done in his book, Business Model Warfare, he talks about the fact that the average lifespan of an S&P 500 company has decreased from more than 50 years to now fewer than 25 today. And he projects forward that he thinks only about a third of today's major corporations are going to look in a couple years the way they look today, that most of them are going to die or be bought out because they don't keep pace with market change. So I think it's all about business model flexibility and innovation, not necessarily about whether that business model involves subsidy. The one thing I will say, last thing about subsidy, is while I don't think that subsidy means you're necessarily fragile or unsustainable, I would agree that business models that involve subsidy are harder to scale. And that's because, as Ira points out, the potential for profits brings investment and growth capital in a much more unlimited way than you see in the nonprofit sector, where you're really reliant on philanthropy and government grants to provide, and generally philanthropy to provide investment capital, because the potential for return is not there. So that just goes back to this point that I think business models need attention. And we need, you know, core investment and core capacity to really grow in a model where there's subsidy involved. The second issue or difference I'd have with the paper is sort of has to do with this idea that maybe some of the leading nonprofits should be looking to become commercial or for-profit institutions. And I know that's only part of what Ira and Jennifer are talking about, but I would just lay out, first of all, we spent a lot of time engaging with practitioners, and I haven't really seen or heard interest in that in the U.S. The credit unions are in a model where they're sustainable and they have, you know, and they're fully sustainable from that financial perspective. But for the other mission-based lenders, the loan funds, I don't think they're looking. I haven't heard them talking about becoming profitable institutions or commercial institutions. And I think that's because in the U.S., just given the complexity and the highly developed nature of our financial markets and our financial sector, I think they're not looking to the same path that we saw internationally, where basically there was a huge market that wasn't being served by any kind of institution, and there was a huge market there to grow and fill. I really feel that in the U.S., the CDFI sector is more about filling gaps in the underserved market and about demonstrating that there should and can be responsible products that are offered. And I think the way that they fill that role is maybe partly by scaling their direct lending activities, but it also may be in terms of the ways they engage in other kinds of activities, including partner with financial institutions and engaging in policy. And so if you look at a group like, you know, if you look at self-help, which is obviously one of the best-in-class CDFIs we have, there's obviously the great work they do in their direct provision of financial services through the credit union and their venture fund, but there's also the work that they did to create a secondary market for mortgage loans, which brought in conventional lenders, and there's their work in the Center for Responsible Lending, which is all about driving policy change. And so I think that's more the model of what our best-in-class CDFIs look like here in the U.S. And then the final point that I made is I think it's important when we talk about the microfinance sector in the U.S. and when we talk about what level of scale is necessary and achievable, and we talk about things like pricing and technologies, to distinguish between consumer products, which are largely sort of the transactional savings and maybe personal credit products, and then at the next level to products that may look and be underwritten more like consumer loans but are targeted to income-generating activities. And that's where I put, you know, Grameen in terms of their work in the U.S. and Progresso. And then and distinguish that then again from larger-scale, longer-term business loans, which is what most of the microenterprise field does in the U.S. And I think in some cases the paper sort of conflates the discussions of those different products and markets, and I think some of the strategies that you think about and some of the pathways to scale are going to look different depending on what that product and that market looks like. So those are my overall remarks, and I look forward to some more in-depth conversation.
Thank you, Joyce. So good outcomes come from disagreements, and we are on the path, no doubt, to good outcomes. Next, I want to invite Connie Evans, the President and CEO of AEO, to share her perspectives on the paper.
Thank you, Tammy, and good afternoon to everyone. I guess I want to make a couple of very, very brief remarks because I am eager to hear from what appears to be a really great group of participants on this call. First, let me say something that Tammy mentioned in her introduction of me at the beginning is that I was smart enough to convince her to come work with me here at AEO because I told her that I really wanted to come and transform the industry. And so I thank Jennifer and Ira for raising issues that I think can lead to transformation in our industry. The issues that were raised in the paper and in their presentation today are the key issues that we at AEO came together, the current team at AEO, I should say, came together to particularly address. And I see those issues being one, you know, the question about demand. They didn't talk a lot about it in the presentation here today, but clearly it is one of the questions and issues that's raised in the paper in terms of if we're talking about reaching scale, is there really demand in the U.S.? And my answer to that, I think, is definitely yes. You know, at AEO, we launched the 1 in 3 campaign with that notion that if 1 in 3 of the Main Street micro businesses hired just one, we could reach full employment. And so we actually see the demand out there, but what we also see is that an inability to access the resources that are available. And then, of course, the other barrier is the lack of available resources. And so between access and availability, there might be market opportunity, but we also have a problem in terms of how do we harness that opportunity and that demand. I'm constantly reminded of the 90% of all the businesses in this country are micro. And so clearly there is opportunity, and we need to find ways to reach what potential there is in terms of demand. The transformative questions raised around scale and sustainability are key in doing that. I think it also leads questions around sustainability, interest rates, and subsidy issues, I think really point to the need for accelerating change in our industry. It's a piece in the report that Ira talked about, and Jennifer mentioned, I guess, on the call today as it relates to just changing the paradigm of how we currently think about those issues. And I think it's clear from my experience working internationally all these years, I've been lucky enough to have had a foot in both the domestic and international market around microfinance for many, many years. And the issues that they grappled with around subsidy and capitalization and scale were all undergirded by a robust funding mechanism, oftentimes from the U.S. But there were many entities that were, in addition to, of course, CGAP, that were providing the kind of infrastructure. And when I say infrastructure, I'm not only just talking about the technology that's needed, but the resources totally needed to bring a variety of donors to the table who helped talk and discuss these issues, who were able to fund robust discussions year after year, experimentation on these issues. And we just have not had that cross-sector of robust support in the industry to tackle these issues, to actually bring about a paradigm shift. And so I think those are critical, critical pieces that will be needed if we're going to accelerate change in the U.S. And one of the last comments I guess I want to make before turning it over to the other participants is a discussion about, you know, a comment about the role of nonprofits and business models. I mean, I happen to support that the idea that nonprofits should be supported for innovation and testing, that working in our local neighborhoods and seeing those nonprofits as the hotbed of innovation is key to our communities, our fabric of our society, and how we're able to find the incredible solutions that have come before us and will come behind us, in front of us, ahead of us. But what I think is key is to recognize that it may not be the appropriate structure for scaling. And so I would hate to see, even though I agree that we need to discuss the issue of sustainability and subsidy, I would hate to see it get brought down into, you know, just an issue about nonprofits and should the nonprofit scale and can it scale. I really think it's important to recognize that there are limitations with nonprofits in their abilities to do certain things. And there are a number of hybrid structures, and several states are creating new laws and regulations that are bringing forth new types of entities that will have the opportunity and the ingredients that are necessary to take, I think, the proper solutions to some of the issues, such as microfinance, solutions to underemployment, solutions to supporting business ownership and entrepreneurship to a larger degree, taking those things to scale. And I would like to think that that's how we're going to be able to continue to have this discussion going forward. Ira mentioned that he will be at the AEO conference to continue this discussion. What I'm actually hoping, and I hope the people on the call will also come to the conference because it will have a little bit longer time to continue this discussion and debate. But I hope this time we actually walk away and use the conference session on sustainability to walk away with a new set of actions. We've been having this discussion in U.S. for nearly 20 years now, and I'm not sure if I've seen, I know I haven't seen enough progress, or I wouldn't be calling for real transformative actions. But I'm hoping we can end the conference with a new set of actions. And it's not that where we are needs to be thrown out, but we need to build on where we are, what's working now, but definitely find a new way of approaching this issue of how do we reach scale and how do we do it by providing high quality fairly priced products and services to underserved entrepreneurs in this country. So I'm going to, again, stop there, open it up to others, invite participants on the call to please weigh in, and again, join us in really transforming and accelerating the change in our industry in the U.S. so that we can, as Yunus said today when he was receiving his Congressional Gold Medal, it was just an amazing service. Let's all of us work to put poverty in the museums. And so I think we can do that. A part of doing that is clearly going to be put to our industry, and I think we are ready to take it on. So with that, Tammy, I'll turn it back over to you. And, again, thank you for your leadership on bringing these issues to the forefront.
Thank you, Connie. Thank you, Joyce, Ira, and Jennifer. I want to open up the conversation now to questions. In an ideal world, folks will either chat them in or raise their hands. And the good news is the questions are starting to come in. Can we unmute Lisa Christian from Women's Initiative, Jackie, so she can join this conversation?
Hi, this is actually Liz DiRenzi with Women's Initiative. Lisa asked me to participate for her.
Excellent. Welcome.
So I was really excited to hear Connie talking about hybrid models and wanted to offer to share what Women's Initiative is currently doing. So we obviously had a problem with scaling our loan program, and we are committed to responsible lending. So I was interested in hearing those comments, too, about how that being important in the nonprofit sector. But we're about doubling our loan program this year by working with banks in sort of a hybrid model by dividing up the labor. So kind of in a nutshell, what you could say is that Women's Initiative is taking on the underwriting and technical assistance part of the loan. The banks are actually providing the capital and making the loan. And we're subsidized, and they're making a profit. So far, the default rate is 0%, and they're able to make loans at a really responsible interest rate for our clients. The interest rates are just 6 to 7.25%. And that's it.
Thank you.
I just wanted to put that out there as sort of another model.
Thank you, Liz. So it's a terrific example of, you know, perhaps disaggregating the value chain or breaking up the activities and getting the best of what each of your partner organizations does. I want to acknowledge Eric Weaver's hand is raised, and if I can figure out the technology, I can. Eric, can you talk?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Excellent. We can hear you.
Okay. Well, a lot to respond to here that is really interesting. I just want to maybe comment on a couple things in the presentation. The first one being the discussion about interest rates, that if U.S. microlenders could bring their rates up to around 18 to 35%, that they might then become sustainable. And I think I just wanted to offer some data from us that we've been doing a lot of work on really breaking down our costs. We've been doing it together with the Axion affiliates. And it's going to depend, for us, it depends very much on loan size. So at just three examples, a $2,500 loan, which is the smallest loan we make, and is pretty small for a U.S. microloan, we calculate that our break-even interest rate on that loan, the way we do things, would be about 83%. Whereas just getting up a little bigger, a $10,000 loan, we think our break-even interest rate is about 28%, which starts to get into the range that Ira and Jennifer were talking about. And then if you get up to a $50,000 loan, which is kind of the high end of what in the U.S. is called a microloan, we believe we can break even at about 14%. And this does include a loan fee, so the APRs are actually – no, actually, the APR is factored in there. So that's just to give a little context. And, again, it's only our data, but we're pretty confident in it. Then I wanted to, and I wanted to note that some of the, we were talking about some of the new for-profit actors. I mean, to our knowledge, they're not profitable. At least Progresso, so far, does not seem to be profitable. We actually took over the operations of Confianza in large part because they were not able to be profitable. So I think Joyce's point about sustainability is a good one. And I think on credit unions, they do provide an interesting infrastructure, but I think the fact that they're regulated actually, rather than being a help, is probably a hindrance to them really meeting the kind of needs that CDFI microlenders meet. So I almost think there has to be a way to change regulations for them to be able to do the kind of lending we do. I also think that they don't do they have the sort of corporate culture needed to really get out and push product and sell to small businesses, which I think is critical to any efforts to scale up. So those are just a few of my thoughts.
Eric, you have probably the most exposure or among the most exposure to the nit-grit of what is fundamentally different or the same between for-profits and not-for-profits, never mind whether they are profitable or not. As you reflect on the experience with Confianza and what you know in the universe, what would you characterize as the fundamental differences between a for-profit and not-for-profit, and what's the secret sauce that needs to be preserved around the not-for-profit?
Around the not-for-profit. That's a really interesting question. I want to be very careful to say that I'm talking about the merger, the differences of, the merger of one particular for-profit and one particular non-profit, and I don't think it would be very, very wise to extrapolate too broadly across all organizations. But I think, frankly, Confianza, simply was running a more efficient operation than we were when we met them. And I do think that there's an element of, when you are, and this was, you take the case of the founder, Marco Lucioni, I mean, he was literally lending out his own money. And he was trying to make, there's a sort of discipline that gives you that I don't, you can be the most, have the hardest work ethic in the world, or have you, but when you've got that sort of driving you, I think it's going to lead you to be very, very efficient. You can be. And I just, so that was what they brought, and I think in terms of, the mission and the secret sauce of the nonprofit, it's just, I've seen it time and again in looking at so-called social enterprises, that organizations that claim to have a double bottom line that's literally equal, where the mission and the profit are just hand in hand, I just don't think it happens. I think, the secret sauce of a nonprofit is that you have a leadership that is truly most focused on making sure that what you're doing is good for the clients. And I think that often can put you into tension as far as scaling goes. Another thing, just rambling here, but with this idea of commercializing microfinance, I mean, I don't know that there's really a lot of good data yet on whether commercial microfinance institutions in developing countries are leading to a lot of positive social outcomes. I think we do have data in the U.S., although we're small, we have data that measures the impact on our borrowers. And so I'm not saying it's not there. I don't know that I've seen it. So to just rush, I mean, if I knew that I could scale up by raising my prices and reducing the amount of time I spend with each client, I'm not sure I would take that deal, I mean, without better data. Stopping there.
Very helpful. Ira, on the international side, are there good sources of the social data? Now, the mixed market seems to have excellent data on the volume and financial performance. Has anybody cracked the code on the social data that methodologies that Eric's described?
That's a very good question, Tammy. Can you hear me? I think in the last 2 to 3 years, there's been a very big push on trying to do more on the social side. And I would agree with Eric, even in the not-for-profits, doing microfinance, focused on microfinance, I think there was always an imbalance where the measurable impact was always on the financial side and much less so on the social side. I think in the last few years, groups like Axion, CGAP, and some major funding groups have looked to do much more about impact. I know the Mix did a survey of all 2,000 institutions on their social performance work, whether it was embedded in their board structures and whether it was being measured regularly, et cetera. So there is this full survey. I'm not sure how many responses of the 2,000 they got, but there is a very comprehensive survey that was done. And I do know that there's been a continuous push to do more about it. So I'd say the industry's gotten a lot better now. I've been a little less involved in that side since a lot of my work, to be clear, is being I'm on the boards of several not-for-profits, and I'm involved, until recently, I was the advisor to the Council on Microfinance Equity Funds, so I was bifurcated. I was either on purely commercial in some ways and or purely not-for-profit, but I really do think the industry internationally has begun to take it very seriously. Also on client protection, better disclosure, as there's been, you know, certain cases in certain sectors and countries of abuse of high interest rates or overlending to clients. So there's been a big push by the industry on client protection and disclosure and transparency of the industry.
Thanks. Next up is Mary Houghton. If you can unmute Mary, she has her hand raised. Mary, you may need to unmute your phone. By star six?
Star seven.
Mary, I think your phone is mute. You need to dial star six.
Seven. Star seven unmutes.
Star seven, sorry. Maybe that's the problem. Is Mary unmuted or?
I'm noticing she's saying she's on Skype, so she may not be able to talk. She may have to. Mary, maybe you could type in your chat question or your comment.
So in the meantime, while we're waiting for Mary to chat, Joyce, Claudia asked a question around the strategy of achieving sustainability by making larger loans. She cited the example of Community Advantage. To essentially subsidize larger loans with smaller loans. Do you have a perspective on that strategy? And the specific question is that a direction that Aspen would like to promote?
Yeah, so I think it's a great question. I think it points to this, I mean, what we still see, I think, here in the U.S. because of the cost basis for making these loans, for making the smallest loans. That's, I think, one of the reasons why there's this inherent tension between scale and sustainability. So I think what we've seen is a number of different organizations moving to also make larger scale loans. In order to do this piece where they're increasing their sustainability, their overall self-sufficiency because they can generate more earned revenue off those larger loans. Whether they're using it to actually cross-subsidize their micro or whether they're just increasing the overall self-sufficiency of the organization, I'm not quite sure. But they're certainly doing that as a way to move towards greater self-sufficiency. I think the tension that we've seen is that many times as organizations do that, it makes it less likely that they're going to focus on what we would sort of say is a true micro portfolio, which are those loans, on the smaller size, the $8,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 loans. And I think that's partly because it becomes harder as you're pushing towards greater self-sufficiency sometimes. The draw is towards the loans that earn more revenue sometimes, if that's where you're putting your focus. I mean, I also think that fundamentally often sort of the costs and the market channels that you're looking at, the costs you need to address in the market channels you're looking at are different for different kinds of loans, and so it's a question of what you have the ability to focus on. From our perspective at Aspen, I don't think we take a position on that because we think it's up to institutions to decide according to their mission and what they're trying to do, which choice they want to make. So, if you're working in a community, it may be that you feel like those larger loans also have greater impact in some other ways, and that's a fine choice for your organization. If you're really committed to saying there's a huge market gap here for the smallest microloans, and what we want to do is grow that segment, then I might say that looking to make those larger loans may distort your focus. I think that what we've seen in the U.S. that for the most part, a lot of the organizations that have really grown their microlending have done it because they've put a really, really strong focus on building their capacity to make loans in that smaller micro range.
And on that note, I want to bring in Selena Pena from Acción Texas into the conversation to share both perspectives on the larger loans and the smaller loans, and I see you also have your hand raised, Selena, so your timing is perfect.
Tammy, what I'd like to do is, after that, add a comment on the business model and what Joyce and Eric have spoken about.
Perfect.
Okay. Hi, this is Selena. Thanks for having us. We appreciate the comments from from all the experts and from some of the folks in the field. From our perspective, I think, Joyce, I was able to attend the Scale Academy, and Eric, I had the opportunity to hear your colleagues speak about your work. For Acción Texas, I think it's obviously what's the right ecosystem for creating and fulfilling a mission and growing your sales. And so we see great potential in our people. They love what they do. And we really have to hone in on their skills and their ability to take ownership and to build opportunity for sales in really small loans. Our average loan size is, even with large loans, this is about $19,000. Without the large loans, it's about $15,000. And we deploy about $1.45 million a month. So I think one of our biggest challenges specifically is being able to commit to building our infrastructure so that we are able to track our work, that we are able to see both short-term outcomes and immediate results on who we're serving, and then also going back and measuring long-term and seeing what that impact is as a social enterprise, if you will. So, I mean, we're always talking about this at our organization, as I'm sure everyone is. And, on the technology side, I have the honor and privilege of working with my colleagues on our MMS structure and to keep up with technology and to keep up with really our ability to serve our clients on our technology side is very challenging as a nonprofit. And so those things we think about, and again, it takes both the people and the technology, and really on top of that, the right ecosystem of everyone saying we want to move forward that has allowed us to do what we do today. And so there's always more room for improvement for us, but we are always also really in a mindset of how do we continue to raise capital to keep improving our efficiencies and to improve our track record as well.
Thanks, Selena. Ira, before you jump in, I'm wondering from a technology perspective, Jackie, if we can unmute a few people so that this can be more of an exchange. But in the meantime, Ira, over to you.
Yeah, I wanted to come in first. You know, I have to say I agree heartily with Joyce on the issue of business model. And actually, the thing that surprised me most when we went around the U.S. was how complex people's business models were, mainly because perhaps they were very focused on individual communities and wanting to service those communities with as many products as they could, or they felt they needed those products to generate enough revenue to cover themselves. But I spent many years in private business, running businesses, before I came to the World Bank and then ran CGAP, and I was saying to myself, God, I don't think I'd want to run those businesses. They're so complex. Also, we noticed the stress of the senior management of the not-for-profits in the U.S., how much time was spent raising capital from different sources. And that was it was not an easy job. It was very difficult, and it was continuous. That, at least that was our impression. If we're wrong, I'd be happy to be told I'm wrong. And so when Joyce raises this issue of self-sufficiency versus sustainability, indeed, we used to talk about self-sufficiency in the international side as well, meaning covering all operating costs, or we talked about financial self-sufficiency, covering financial costs as well as operating costs, until we began to realize that that wasn't workable, partially because if you really wanted to raise capital continuously, you had to be attractive to capital markets, where donors were always episodic because they work on a project basis. So if you don't want to spend all your life looking for capital, then you have to look at your business model and perhaps be more sustainable, which is indeed a definition where Joyce and ourselves differed. It's not so much of difference, I think it's a bit of emphasis. And again, I'm by far not pushing everyone to move to a for-profit market model. The other issue that I'd like to make is there will certainly be subsidy in all of this, and even the best of microfinance institutions, unless they're very large, and there are many of them around the world that now have over 100,000 clients, and many of them with several million clients. But if you're going way downstream to very poor clients, like BRAC does in Bangladesh, then the subsidy element comes in. So the idea is to continually diminish the amount of subsidy. I think it's hard to eliminate it because if you're scaling, the larger the subsidy, the more money you need to raise on a continuous basis. And that's where it becomes very difficult to scale. And I think that's where Joyce agreed with us, that scale becomes very difficult. But let's be blunt. The U.S. microfinance industry is way far away from sustainability. So the question is, how do you get these institutions closer to sustainability, not that they, or self-sufficiency, not that they can reach full self-sufficiency or full sustainability, but there should be a drive in the industry to get much closer. I don't think 25% cuts it, frankly, to be very blunt.
John Arnsmeyer from Small Business Majority has his hand raised. John, go ahead.
Hey, can you hear me, or do I need to press another button here?
We can hear you well.
Oh, great. Okay, hi, Tammy. Well, thanks for all of this, and you know, most of all of the presenters certainly and folks on the phone probably know more about the mechanics of how this all works. But what, you know, one thing that we know for sure, just being out talking to small businesses all the time, is this is a huge problem, and it's particularly the problem is even bigger the smaller you get in terms of the size of the business and the size of the need. And you know, our job is to try to translate those needs into effective public policy, and we get asked all the time by policymakers, okay, well, what can we do? Give me an idea. I'd like to run with this. I'd like to do something. So I guess I'd like to throw out to a number of you, you know, two or three of sort of top things that you think, both on a federal level or even on a state level, that policymakers should be doing about this.
Lisa from Women's Initiative, or actually it's Liz Durenzi, even if it says Lisa. Just jump in, please. Unmute your phone by dialing *7.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello? I just wanted to point out that the CRA is so important. It's a huge motivator for banks to work together with us. Even though we're doing the underwriting in TA, it's definitely part of why they're motivated to work with us is because they get points for CRA.
Okay.
Others have policy recommendations or ideas? Continue doing what we're doing or add to the mix for John?
And I would put out two items. One would be support for an industry-wide database to allow the industry to report in and have that data analyzed and presented against peer data. You could keep confidentiality, but I think a lot of the institutions really don't compete since they work in discrete regional areas. There are not a lot of nationwide institutions. And we found in microfinance internationally that even in countries where people compete, they've been willing to disclose the data to the mix. And that has allowed researchers and investors to look at the data and evaluate institutions, and it serves as the kicking off point for attracting private money because they have data that they can analyze and start the process with. So that's one. I think
who would manage the database?
Well, I mean, you right now internationally, that's an affiliate of CGAP and themixmarket.com, and it actually has, or .org, I guess, and it has institutions like Citicorp and various funders on its board. You have Field who could manage it. You have a variety of institutions, and it could be a joint venture of several institutions, including AEO, Field, and even the Treasury. That's one. The second area, I think there should be a move, and this is probably would have to be state by state, but we actually did it country by country using CGAP as the policy organ. By the way, CGAP is now a policy institute and a knowledge institute. It doesn't fund because there's so much more funding in the market that soon after I left, it became inappropriate for CGAP to continue funding, although I think it would still help if they were funding in terms of TA, some of the poorest markets. But I think that you need to start removing the interest rate caps. Those caps come from, and actually that's the biggest fight we had in individual markets, not to allow interest rate caps to occur. I mean, all the economic data will tell you if there's interest rate caps, you create distortions in the market. And I'm not saying that the MFIs domestically should suddenly start raising interest rates to the sky. I think they should be allowed to test appropriate rates that both serves their clients and allow them to be sustainable. And the interest rate caps now come from a variety of ways. One, I think they're limited by SBA. Two, I think Treasury, but I'm not sure about that, the CDFI funding. Three, the major banks sort of discourage them when funds come through CRA lending. It's not official, but it's sort of frowned upon. Although the major banks know very well what it would cost to get into the market, and that's why they're not in the market. And by the way, the last point to that, Joyce, is the reason I think there's a niche that's not going to go away is because the major banks have deleveraged and the credit card companies have deleveraged, and I don't see them coming back down market very soon, and they've left a big gap. I think there's a big demand gap, and I think there's room to fill that.
Jennifer, can I jump in for a second?
Please.
Okay, so Ira, there's also state interest rate cap regulations. I can't remember if you said that or not. But just in my experience working in the transition economies in former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, when I was with the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, one of our major policy dialogue efforts was to work with the central banks in each of the countries where we were on the specific issue of interest rate caps. And you know, we places that were trying to instigate them, we would work with the central bank to say no, and we were very successful in at least for the microfinance industry to say this is an industry that, you know, for certain reasons needs to not have those caps. There might be on the consumer side reasons to have them, but for microfinance there's a certain cost to doing business, and you'll put microfinance institutions out of business if you have these caps.
Well, thanks. That's helpful. We're always looking for new ideas that we can. As I said, policymakers really want to. Some of them really want to help, and they want to know what they can do.
Sammy, this is Joyce. I just want to jump in with a couple more maybe policy ideas. The first one is I want to get back to this issue of investments in core capacity building. Because I do think that some of the institutions that have grown, and this is on the scale question, not necessarily in the sustainability question, because until you get your cost figure out, you know, you're going to become less sustainable, as Ira says, as you scale. But I think the organizations that we've seen really grow recently are the ones who've really figured out how to reach their customers more effectively and more efficiency, and they've used technology to do that. And in some cases, it's not the most high-tech things they've done, like mobile banking, but there are lots of different ways. I think Eric's team has done some of this work in terms of building new market channels, in terms of using technology to get their loan officers in the field, in terms of things like MMS. People have really focused on how do we improve the efficiency, because we do have a cost issue right now, which is one of the problems that's limiting scale and limiting sustainability. And so, again, because these institutions aren't profitable as yet, there needs to be some investment capital that gets in and drives that question. And the other thing I would – so that's one big policy piece. And the other policy area that I think is worth exploring, and it gets to this question of demand and who's going to fill demand that Ira brought up. I do agree that there's a demand question out there, but I'd be interested maybe to hear from some of the other lenders whether that demand issue is all about the issue of a complete inability to access any capital, and how much of it is about there's capital available out there, but it's capital that's either predatory or at the very least the kind of capital that doesn't allow the business to grow over time. So, you know, are people going to loan brokers and getting hard money loans, or are they getting, you know, what kinds of commercial financing are there options that they're availing themselves of if they don't have a better alternative, and are they therefore choosing not to borrow? So I think there's actually more information we need on the demand side. And then the other question I think that there's a lot of thinking about in terms of the whole question of how to address the underbanked market is, again, how much of that market is filled by the nonprofits scaling up, and how much of it is filled by partnerships by the for-profits, or between partnerships between for-profit and non-profit. And that's where I think the question of regulation and how regulation plays out past the financial crisis that we might have may have a lot to do with it. So,
thanks, Joyce.
So I am very mindful of time. We also have a very good problem, which is a lot of hands raised. Let's do Phyllis Cassidy, then Laura McKinley, then Dan Betancourt, and then Claudia, and I hope we will get through those, but let's start with you, Phyllis.
Yeah, first of all, disclaimer, I come more from the consumer perspective, so I'm a training-led organization, small community, but from a federal perspective, I know the Department of Transportation has a program where they actually lend money to subcontractors who are working on federal grants. So, you know, part of the problem is federal money coming through the state, coming through the city, coming from a developer, coming through a prime. The subcontractors are floating the working capital of this deal. And if there was a way for the federal government to work with micro lenders to deploy that money more directly, sort of as gap financing, I think that has a lot of potential for, one, helping the small businesses and also getting more, you know, greater sources of funding. The other thing is, you know, we are partnering the Kiva program in New Orleans, and one thing we don't talk about when we talk about demand is the lack of loan readiness for a lot of small businesses. Poor credit scores, don't have financial reports. I would say fully 80% of the people who apply for Kiva loans can hardly meet or can't meet the very limited underwriting criteria of that. So.
Thanks, Phyllis. Laura McKinley.
Can y'all hear me?
We can. Welcome, Laura.
Well, I'm with a community development credit union who's recently become a community development credit union, and we have the low-income designation. And so I wanted to first just address one of the speakers that may have been Ira was questioning or wondering how effective low-income designated credit unions would be, and because of the regulatory issue. And I just wanted to say from I've been involved now going on 2 years with in the credit union after 30 years in community banking. And from my perspective, the NCUA is especially at the highest levels with Director Matt is very supportive of this happening, I think. I think now when it gets down to the regulators that are sitting in my credit union today with NCUA, they're not nearly as comfortable as Director Matt is, and I think if she will continue to support, give support like they've been doing at the national level, I think it will eventually filter down. And as low-income designated credit unions like us get in a position through capitalization to work on scale, then I think the field examiners will kind of come along. The regulatory environment, from my perspective, in NCUA compared to FDIC is much more receptive and could be much more supportive. The other thing I was going to say or address from a demand standpoint is from being down here really on the street with consumers and small business owners is that there is absolutely demand, and a lot of them are getting their money directly from investors. They're going out to other sources. There really is not the kind of products out there that they need. A lot of banks still are not lending, and some of the, like OnDeck and some of these other alternative lenders really aren't available in all markets. I mean, I'm in kind of a middle-sized market, maybe not in Atlanta or anything like that, but we're kind of between Savannah and Jacksonville, part of which are some smaller, you know, would be considered a smaller market. But there's absolutely, from what I see, there absolutely is demand.
Thanks, Laura. Dan Betancourt, I think you will have the honor of being the last question or comment.
Thank you, Tammy. No pressure, right? Mike, I think the earlier speakers, I had more of a comment, and then I have another comment about community first. One is that there was a comment made that the CDFIs in the U.S. are focused on niche markets, which makes a lot of sense. That's, and But there wasn't a lot of background given on that. It would be great to hear a comment about that if you know, there's other thoughts around it. Clearly, you know, our CDFI certification really limits what we do because you really have to say how you're going to serve a niche market and you're rated on that. And quite frankly, when you apply for core funding, which is extremely competitive, you have to demonstrate your ability to reach those niche markets. So, and then in terms of the whole subsidy discussion that we had, we're a perfect example of an organization that has does microenterprise, does microlending, but has moved into some of these larger SBA loans with 7A guarantees. I think our average is probably about $80,000. And while we're lending, you know, maybe I think this year we're going to lend $8 million. And maybe the average we lent in the past was about $2 million when we were just doing microloans. Our self-sufficiency has gone up, but the fact of the matter is when you have to lend at that level amount of loan, you have to hire much more expensive staff, and so our fixed costs have gone up. And quite frankly, our earned income has tripled, but our expenses have gone up substantially. So our self-sufficiency is going up, our interest income is going up, but our expenses are going up. So I'm not sure that we're any better off, other than, quite frankly, and this was the comment that some of the speakers made, we're doing it for the right reason. We're trying to meet community needs. We want to grow with our microenterprise clients, and they're growing, and they need that. There's more demand. So in the end, I guess we're doing it for the right reasons, but I don't think we're doing it for financial reasons.
Thank you, Dan. Fortunately or unfortunately, we have a terrific problem, which is there's a lot of threads of rich discussion that could go on for hours and days and a very long time. Unfortunately, we have come to the end of our time and actually past our time. I will take the prerogative of going 2 minutes over and asking Connie, Joyce, Ira, and Jennifer if you want to each take a quick moment to close with perspectives on the future or next steps.
Okay, this is Jennifer. I'm happy to start with just one small comment, sort of playing off of what Dan just said about subsidies, self-sufficiency, et cetera. So I think for me, when I think about it, I think about institutions being able to strategically match their revenue streams to specific expenses so that their most reliable revenues for core operating expenses are tied to their lending activities, and their more volatile revenues are associated with expenses that can be reduced while maintaining lending activities at near or current levels. And I think if institutions could really focus on teasing out the difference there and making sure and matching revenue and expense streams, that would make them less, I know I use the word fragile, but less susceptible to changes in the operating environment, whether it be on the funding side or the business environment side, et cetera. So I just leave you with that small comment.
Thanks, Jennifer.
Should I go, this is Ira?
Go for it, Ira.
Yeah, first I want to thank the participants, and I thought there were a lot of good comments and questions, and none of these are very easy, and they take a lot of thought. I would just join Jennifer, because one of our recommendations in the report is that people try to drive their microfinance or their lending business, which could include small business finance. And by the way, on the international side, microfinance institutions have also migrated to doing small business lending, but as soon as they get to medium business lending, they get in real trouble because they don't have the underwriting skills. So I think it was Dan suggested that they were moving up the loan size and getting into more sophisticated loans, and therefore you required more skilled underwriters or lending staff. But I think if you were able to segregate the lending side and make that self-sufficient, then you could focus the other services and scale it to the extent that you can raise money for it. you know, technical assistance funds, grant funds. The other comment would be that if CDFI, I haven't heard anyone comment on the bond, but if CDFI could take a five-year perspective on its lending to the industry, I know that may not be easy due to budget appropriations, and actually maintain a line of credit to the quality institutions as opposed to having them apply in every year or every other year or getting a grant one year and not getting a grant, you know, a funding another year. But if they could continuously monitor, and that's where better data and reporting comes in, so it would be much better for efficiency purposes and productivity purposes and performance purposes to have continuous funding and then ongoing monitoring of institutions rather than have these episodic funding as at present. I think that would make a whale of a difference in the industry.
Thanks, Ira. Joyce?
Parting thoughts? I have to take myself off mute. Thank you. It's been a great conversation, and you know, I think we've hit on, you know, what are some of the really critical challenges facing the field right now, particularly as it gets to the issue of scale, which it has to do with issues of, as we talked about, business models and technology and the need for how do we find the investment capital to really help organizations grow and improve their efficiency. And I guess I think, you know, policy is key here, and I'm glad to hear John raise that as an issue, and there's, I think, a need to get some more creative about that. I'm not sure I have all the answers to that question. The other thing I'd say is that I think Ira's absolutely right. I think these are really hard businesses to run. And fortunately, we've got some really great folks in the field who are putting their minds to this process. It's a joy for us at Field to work with many of them every day. So hopefully we can take the opportunities we have, like the AEO conference and other venues, to continue to wrestle with these issues and come up with some good answers.
Connie, you get the parting.
Thank you, Tammy, and thank all of you for the great discussion and for all the comments and questions that were raised here. I think I will close by just inviting you once again to engage with AEO on these discussions and issues. I actually heard and took notes on a number of ideas that surfaced from regulatory tweaks, perhaps at CDFI and others, where we can begin to, I think, put together not only industry data and, you know, documenting operational needs and sustainability issues and needs to make some of these changes, but being able to marry that with some of the demand things that we're seeing, that the AEO research is showing around demand. So I think there are some real opportunities to for us to engage and go much deeper into recommending some solutions and advocating together for these, not only on the government regulatory side, but also around this capital issue. I just think it's really past the time. Now is the time for us to, you know, do something we haven't done before in the U.S. around engaging donors to the table in a different kind of discussion than maybe we've had before. So, again, my invitation is to all of you on the call is to engage with us in that. And, again, I would be remiss if I didn't take you to Tammy's last, I think what might be one of the last slides, which is to, again, kind of focus on the opportunity to do that at the conference, another place. We'll have a discussion that's actually going to be led by Eric Weaver on this conversation around sustainability in the making. Ira will join Melissa Bradley and Joel Holstein on some of the issues related to capitalization strategies. And Daniel Delahanty will have a number of funders, not only those listed, but several others who will be joining him from foundations as well as financial institutions to talk about how do we get funders on the same page
with us, regardless of what they call their funding, financial inclusion, asset development, micro, small business. How do we get them at the same page that the rest of us are and on the track where we all need to go together? So with that, Tammy, thank you again. I'll let you say parting words to close us out, I guess.
Thanks to everyone for participating. It is exactly what we knew, that there are a lot of issues to be discussed, and I look forward to seeing you all in St. Louis and in continuing the conversation in the weeks, months, and probably years to come. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.